All right, again, thank you very much for inviting me to give a seminar here. I must say that I'm personally very excited to be here for many reasons. So this is my first time giving a seminar ever. And so it's also my first time talking about this particular paper. But on top of that, it's also my first time here at Perimeter and at Canada itself. So there kind of a lot of first times for me in this particular trip. And I really look forward to the rest of my visit here. Right, so this is work with my supervisor, Daniel Bauman, and my collaborator, Rafael Porto, on trying to find new ways of probing the existence of ultralight bosons through binary black holes. So let me first start with, as I'm sure everyone in the audience knows, what has been a groundbreaking discovery by the LIGO collaboration about two years ago for the very first direct detection of gravitational waves emitted from a binary black hole. So it's clear that this gravitational wave detection and many of the subsequent ones, which include the binary neutron star, has already transformed astrophysics in many ways and will continue to do so with future gravitational wave experiments. But I think what is less clear, though, is the question of, you know, what can we learn about physics beyond the standard model through these amazing future gravitational wave observations. So one interesting class of physics beyond the standard model consists of particles that are light and weakly interacting with the standard model. So some of the canonical examples include the QCD axion, axions arising from string compactification in string theory, dark radiation, and so on. So the small masses of these particles can be explained, or rather said differently, they are technically natural if they're protected by some unknown symmetries in nature. And the weak couplings would imply that they, you know, they're hard to reproduce through colliders because of small cross-sections. However, if these particles do indeed exist in nature, and if they constitute a sizable fraction of the energy density of the universe, by virtue of the equivalence principle, they could potentially be probed through gravity. For example, either through cosmology, astrophysics, or even in black hole physics. Okay. So indeed, one of the ways in which ultralight bosons can manifest themselves in nature is through a process called black hole superradiance. Now, I'll explain what superradiance is in slightly more detail in the later part of my talk. But this, at this point, it's enough to say that this is a process where when the quantum wavelength of this boson field is of the order of the size of a rotating black hole, the field can extract energy and angular momentum from the black hole such that you form a cloud of boson condensate around this black hole. And the mass of the cloud can be up to the total mass of the cloud can be up to 30% of the mass of the initial black hole. So this can really be a non-trivial amount of, you know, mass distribution contained in the cloud. For reasons I'll explain in more precisely later on, this configuration is sometimes known as the gravitational atom. So here I've shown you an illustration of the scales, the length scales of black holes. So on the lower end here, I have about a kilometer in size, which is the size of a stellar mass black hole, and all the way up to about 10 to the 10 kilometers, which is the size of some of the most massive, supermassive black holes that we have observed in nature in the form of quasars. And just for a comparison of scales, I'll just show you the sizes of our Earth and the Milky Way on this figure. Now, if you use this Compton wavelength matching condition that I just described in a slide earlier, that so this 10 orders of magnitude in the mass range of black holes roughly translates into probing 10 orders of magnitude in the mass of the ultralight bosons. In particular, the mass range being probed ranged from 10 to the minus 20 to 10 to the minus 10 electron volts. And again, just to give you a sense of comparison of scales, the lightest known massive particles that we have observed in nature, the neutrinos, have a sum of masses of about a milli electron volts. So the mass range being probed here is really, you know, orders of magnitude lighter than the neutrinos. So this cloud of boson condensate contains a whole range of very interesting phenomenologies. And they're mostly spelled in this paper by Mina and Sergey. So one of the observables that is most relevant for the rest of my talk is the fact that this cloud is a continuous source of monochromatic gravitational waves, which is, I think, is a very important search target for current and future gravitational wave experiments, and I presume which is something that we discuss extensively in the upcoming workshop on superradiance. Right, so the focus of my talk is that when this cloud is part of a binary, the presence of a companion introduces new scales into the setup, and that comes with new dynamics. So here I've illustrated one particular example where the companion has a mass that's smaller than this gravitational atom. So now there's a new length scale associated to the separation of the binary. And on top of that, there's a new time scale associated to the orbital frequency of the binary. In terms of phenomenology, the way I like to think about this, rather complicated setup, is that the presence of the companion perturbs the cloud, and therefore it affects the monochromatic gravitational wave signal that I just described earlier. And on the other hand, the presence of the cloud perturbs the trajectory of the companion, and therefore it affects the gravitational wave signal emitted from the binary. So as you can probably imagine, this is a kind of a highly dynamical system, and therefore there's a lot of new phenomenologies associated to the setup. In particular, these new phenomenologies appear in the form of a new time evolution, a new time scale of the evolution of the cloud, something that I'll call the resonance effect, and the way the presence of the cloud leaves its imprint on the signal from the binary come in the form of finite size effects that I'll explain in more detail later on. So in the rest of my talk, I'll divide the rest of my talk into three parts. So in the first part, I'll describe this cloud in isolation. I'll first discuss how they're formed through superradiance. And then I'll review some of the key properties of the cloud that will be important for the rest of my talk. And then in the second part, I'll then describe the dynamics of this cloud in a binary. I'll first focus on how the presence of a companion induces gravitational quadrupole couplings to this cloud. And then I'll also discuss how the orbital motion of the binary induces something called the resonance effect that I just mentioned earlier. And in the last part, I'll briefly sketch some of the new phenomenologies of the system. And broadly speaking, I can divide this discussion into two parts, one where I discuss the signal coming from the cloud and the signal coming from the binary. So this is roughly the big picture sort of outline of my talk. Right. Any questions up to this point? No? All right, so let me first start with part one, where I talk about this cloud in isolation. So black hole superradiance. So one way to think about black hole superradiance is the following. So suppose you consider having an ingoing wave heading towards a rotating black hole. And this wave has a frequency given by omega and an azimuthal angular momentum number given by m. So this combination of omega over m is sometimes known as the angular phase velocity of the wave. Now, if this black hole is spinning sufficiently rapidly such that the angular velocity of the event horizon, which I call capital omega h here, is larger than the angular phase velocity of this wave, then superradiance can happen. And what that means is that this wave heads towards a black hole, and then it scatters off from a black hole, and out comes a wave which has larger amplitude than what was initially sent in, at the expense of extracting some energy and angular momentum from the black hole. So in this picture, superradiance is illustrated as if it is a scattering process. And it is as if that the rotating black hole is emitting radiation through stimulated emission, so stimulated by some ingoing wave. But it turns out that when Zeldovich initially conceived of this idea of superradiance, he also had the idea that superradiance can also happen spontaneously. Okay, so meaning if you have some background field with some angular phase velocity of this form, and if the black hole is spinning sufficiently rapidly, it can spontaneously radiate this field. Actually, speaking of spontaneous emission of black hole, I just read about a story a few months ago that was told by Kip Thorne that, so when Zeldovich realized all of this idea of superradiance in the early 1970s, and so Stephen Hawking paid his first visit to the Soviet Union, I think in 1973. He was accompanied by Kip Thorne at the time, And at that visit, Zeldovich told Hawking about the idea that black holes can spontaneously radiate. And that proved to be a very crucial inspiration for Hawking to formulate what has been now, perhaps more famously known as Hawking radiation. So I thought this is kind of a, like a cute, nice little piece of, you know, history of physics. Right, so now suppose, hypothetically, you put a reflecting mirror around this rotating black hole. So what happens is that initially I have this incoming wave and it scatters off with a larger amplitude. And now with the presence of this reflecting mirror, this wave gets bounced back and backscatters into the black hole and experiences superradiance amplification again, and out comes a wave which is much larger than what is initially sent in. So this process could keep happening until the spin of the black hole decreases sufficiently small such that the superradiance condition or the inequality saturates. Okay? At this point, then the process of amplification stops. So this scenario is sometimes known as the black hole bomb scenario. It was first conceived by Press and Tucholsky, also in the early 1970s. So this is a rather contrived system, admittedly, right? But it turns out that if you have a massive field around a curved black hole, the mass of the field naturally plays the role of a reflecting mirror. So here I've shown you a diagram of the effective potential of the system. So having a boson field around a curved black hole. So on the y-axis, I have the magnitude of the effective potential. On the x-axis, I have the radial tortoise coordinates. So in this direction, I'm approaching the event horizon, and at large distances, I'm just approaching infinity. So the crucial point is that with the existence of a massive field, the mass of the boson field changes the asymptotic structure of curved spacetime at large distances. In particular, now you have a mass barrier whose height is given by the mass of this boson field. So if you have a wave whose frequency omega is smaller than the height of this mass barrier, you can actually form bound states around this localized potential well. So this is where the cloud I just described earlier sits, essentially, around the black hole. So right, so although superradiance happens for, you know, boson fields in general, in the rest of my talk, I only focus on scalar fields. And in particular, I only focus on free massive scalar fields. So I'm not considering any interactions at all at the moment for simplicity. So now consider having a Klein-Gordon equation around a background curved geometry. At large distances, the curved metric in Boyer-Lingwitz coordinates take this particular form, where its deviation from the flat metric is parameterized by this M of R term, which is the gravitational potential sourced by the central black hole. And then there's also an off-diagonal piece, which is sourced by the spin of the black hole. So it's proportional to the A parameter, which is the spin of the black hole. As I'll describe later on, the way that this spin acts on the scalar field is it is as if that this preferred direction, the spin of the black hole, plays the role of a magnetic field. This will be more precise later on. Okay, now suppose I define a new variable that I call little psi here, and it's the non-relativistic field defined via this particular ansatz. So what it means is that I factorize a fast oscillating term here, this e to the I mu t, where mu is the mass of the scalar field. And then I leave all of the slow dependence of the relativistic field here is all suppressed into this non-relativistic field. Said differently, this little psi here varies on a time scale that's much slower than inverse of mu. Okay? If you solve for the equation of motion for little psi, you see that you restore a Schrödinger equation with a Coulomb-like central potential. So the Coulomb central potential has this particular form. It's minus because it's attractive force. And the coupling is given by this alpha parameter, where alpha is defined in natural units, the product of the mass of the black hole to the mass of the scalar field. This combination of parameter can also be rewritten as the ratio of the gravitational radius of the black hole to the Compton wavelength of the scalar field. So this is where the analogy with the hydrogen atom comes into play. Where essentially, you really just restore an equation that we're all familiar with in our quantum mechanics course. So this alpha parameter really is, you know, it plays almost the most crucial role when we try to describe this cloud around the black hole. And as you see, and I'll try to explain later on in the later part of my talk, the range of physically motivated values of alpha range from 10 to the minus 3, roughly, to 0.5. In other words, alpha is smaller than 1. So since alpha is smaller than 1, I can do an expansion of high order corrections in alpha in this for the leading order non-relativistic Schrodinger equation. Okay, so just like the hydrogen atom, each of the eigenstates of little psi is characterized by the quantum numbers. So the three quantum numbers are n, l, and m. So n is called the principal quantum number, which characterizes the number of nodes along the radial direction. L, which is the orbital quantum number, which characterizes the total angular momentum of the system. And m is the azimuthal quantum number. And this m is the same m as the one that I showed for the superradiance condition. Okay. So this cloud has a characteristic Bohr radius, again, just like the hydrogen atom of this particular expression. So RC is this typical location of this cloud. M is the gravitational, the size of the black hole. And this particular ratio is scales as 1 over alpha squared. So if alpha is small, the peak of this cloud is much spread out. Compared to the size of the black hole. So again, just like the hydrogen atom, if you compute the energy spectrum of this gravitational atom, you find that at leading order, so let me explain what these terms are. So at leading order, the energy spectrum is given by this expression, where you have mu, which is the mass barrier that I factorized out just now, and then you have a term that scales as alpha squared over n squared. So this is where, this is the typical Bohr energy levels that we have all learned in our quantum mechanics course. But rather remarkably, the analogy between the gravitational and the hydrogen atom also holds to higher order corrections if you take the relativist corrections of the potential into account. Said differently, if you consider not just the Coulomb-like 1 over r potential, but if you also consider the 1 over r squared, 1 over r cubed terms in the Schrodinger equation, you can compute these relativistic corrections to the energy spectrum. So the order alpha to the 4, you have a term which scales as alpha 4 over n to the 4. This has a term that can be interpreted as the relativistic corrections to the kinetic energy of the hydrogen atom. And then at order alpha 4, you still have another term where the dependence on the L quantum number first appears. And this term can be interpreted as the fine structure splitting, you know, just as something that we have also have seen in the case of the hydrogen atom. If you compute the spectrum at higher order, at order alpha to the 5, so this is where the dependence on M first appears, and it is proportional to the spin of the black hole. So this is the term, you know, what I meant by the spin of the black hole plays a role for magnetic field. It is as if the spin acts in a preferred direction, and it's like the Zeeman effect in the hydrogen atom, where you split the degeneracy of modes of different m values. In the case of a hydrogen atom, this term arises where you have spin interactions between the nucleus and the electron wave function. And in this case, it is as if the role of the nucleus is replaced by the black hole. So it's kind of neat how these analogies do come into play. So here I've shown you the energy level diagram up to some value of N and L. So up in this direction, I have the Bohr-like energy splittings. In this direction, I have the fine structure splittings. And for a given value of N and L, I have a block here where there are two L plus one number of states where the which is, and this splitting is dictated by the hyperfine splitting. Also notice that this is actually a positive term, so the larger the value of M, the higher the energy level within this block. This actually turns out to play a very crucial role in the later part of my talk. All right, so unlike the hydrogen atom, these states are actually not stationary, but only quasi-stationary. And this is because of the event horizon of the black hole. So you can imagine that now, because of the black hole, most can actually decay or be reabsorbed into the black hole. So not all these states are not perfectly stable and stationary. So what this means is that if you look at the energy spectrum, I also have an imaginary piece. And this imaginary component, I call it capital gamma. And gamma is called the instability rate, which is given by this expression. So let me first express, let me explain what this expression means. So I have a 1 over m term, where this is basically the typical time scale of the instability rate, where m is the light crossing time of the black hole. I have the superradiance condition built into it, so that when the superradiance inequality is satisfied, this term is positive, so that the instability rate is positive, so you have a growing mode. Okay. And on the other hand, if the superradiance condition is violated, this is negative and you have a decay mode. Okay. Now there's also a dependence on alpha that scales as 4L plus 5, and this is a very strong dependence on alpha, as I'll explain later. So if you stare at this expression at the superradiance condition, so positive growing modes can only, so this term can only be positive if M is positive. Said differently, a superradiantly growing mode can only grow if it co-rotates with the black hole. Okay? If M is zero or negative, the mode must decay back into the black hole. So this is where, if you just focus on this block, the M equals to 1 term is a growing mode, which I've illustrated here with a solid green line. And then these other states are decaying modes, which I've illustrated with red dashed lines.
I just had a question about the energy splitting that you're calculating.
Yeah.
So there, is it sufficient to just take the hydrogen wave function on the curve background?
Yeah.
And the corrections are not important?
So it turns, so you mean corrections to the wave function?
Yeah.
Yeah, those corrections turn out to come out only at the order of alpha to the 6.
6, okay.
So those don't affect the energy splittings here, fortunately. Right, so in principle, when superradiance happens, you can excite all of the growing modes, so not only this mode, but also all of these solid lines, okay? I remind you there's really, in principle, an infinite tower of states in the n direction and also in the l direction. However, when superradiance saturates, it turns out that this mode is the only dominant occupied mode. So this mode has a quantum number of n, l, and m equals to 2, 1, 1. So recall the expression for the instability rate that I just showed you earlier, and plug in these quantum numbers, you find that gamma is proportional to alpha to the 9. And this, you know, alpha to the 9 dependence, you know, is just means that the instability rate is extremely sensitive to the value of alpha. It can easily range from, you know, this growth rate can easily range from just minutes, you know, to billions of years or the age of the universe, depending on what alpha is. Right, so if you look at the, so if I plot the profile of this cloud along the radial direction, sorry, before I move into that. So it turns out that for this dominant growing mode, the 2, 1, 1, to grow, alpha has an upper bound of 0.5. And intuitively, the reason is that for alpha larger than 0.5, the Compton wavelength of the field is shorter than the event horizon. And therefore, it is as if it's trapped and cannot grow. Does that make sense? I'm not sure if this is the right physical intuition, but at least that's how I interpret it. So again, back to this figure. If I plot the radial function of this cloud, so here I have the size of the black hole, which scales as m, the gravitational radius. And then I have the Compton wavelength, m over alpha by definition. And then recall that I showed you expression for the characteristic ball radius of the cloud, which scales as m over alpha square. So that's where the peak of this cloud is. So you have this characteristic ball-like radial profile. Okay. So wrapping up this part one of my talk, I want to emphasize that this cloud of boson condensate is actually a source of monochromatic gravitational wave that I just advertised in the introduction part of my talk. So if you look at the expression for the power of this emission of gravitational waves, it scales as the square of the mass of the cloud that I denote here with mc. And on top of it, and again, most crucially, it scales as alpha to the 14. Okay, so again, this is another place where the dependence on alpha is so sensitive that a tiny change in the actual value of alpha can significantly affect the emission efficiency of the gravitational wave. But recall that I showed you that the instability rate of this dominant growing mode scales as alpha to the 9, whereas this scales as alpha to the 14. And since alpha is smaller than 0.5, or rather, said differently, smaller than 1, it means that this emission of gravitational waves is always suppressed relative to the growth rate of the cloud. So what that means is that this cloud will grow, the growth of the cloud will not be inhibited by this source of dissipation of the cloud. Oh, by the way, so this, it turns out that this emission of cloud only happens for real scalar fields. So this is a subtlety. It turns out that for complex scalar fields, you do not source this gravitational wave emission. And the reason for that is, if you look at the configuration or the energy density of this cloud for a complex scalar field, it is time independent and axisymmetric. So by virtue of time independence and axisymmetry, you do not source perturbations of the metric, at least a time-dependent perturbation of the metric. Okay? So when the cloud is in isolation, this is a dominant source of instability of the cloud. Now moving on to part two of my talk, where...
Just a comment on the complex case.
Sure.
There's a bit of a, I think there's a bit of a subtlety there as well, is that you're assuming that the phases of the complex field are exactly such that...
Right.
That's not really clear why that should be the case.
But so the time independence and axis
symmetry... That's an assumption about how the complex field grows.
But this is a generous statement due to the U1 symmetry of the complex field.
So I don't think so in these cases. So if you start with black hole and no complex field around it,
mm-hmm.
and you just throw some initial configuration, I think for generic configurations, you will end up with gravitational wave emission.
But they're much more suppressed compared to
the... More than one, I think.
We can talk about this later on, but really... So the way I think about this is that if you look at the energy momentum tensor for a complex scalar field, you don't have a, you know, back to the point, it is time independent.
Yeah, that's only if you have equal.
What they're saying is with the complex scalar field, it's possible to have an axisymmetric configuration, but it's not necessarily, you can also have non axisymmetric configurations.
I see, I see what you're saying.
If you want to put it in there,
Even in the linear analysis? Even in linear analysis?
No, it's just not clear why you can. I mean, you basically need the real and imaginary part of the fields to be exactly in phase to get an axisymmetric configuration, right?
So. We can talk about that in the later part. Right, so moving on to part two of my talk. So again, I remind you that when the cloud is in isolation, this is one source of instability of the cloud. However, once this cloud is part of a binary, I'll show that with the presence of a companion, because of the perturbation generated by the companion, you can actually open up a new source of instability of the cloud. And this new channel of instability happens at a timescale that's much faster than the monochromatic gravitational wave signature. Is there any question about part one of my talk up to this point? No? All right. So I'll start part two by working the limit where the companion is far away from the cloud, okay, and they're in spiraling towards each other. So because of this separation of scales, I can organize the gravitational perturbation of the companion on the cloud in terms of a multiple expansion. I also consider only the Newtonian leading order perturbation and ignore the relativistic corrections of the perturbation for the rest of my talk. So the Newtonian potential in free falling frame, so by free falling frame, I really mean in the Fermi co-moving center of mass frame of the cloud. Okay. So in this particular choice of coordinates, the potential can be written in this particular form of the multiple expansion. So in leading order, I have M star, which is the mass of the companion. I have capital R star, which is the separation of the binary. So this is a monopole piece. And in this term, effectively, you're treating the cloud as a point-like particle, and you're just considering the Newtonian acceleration between the two bodies. And then if you consider higher order multiple expansion of the potential, because of the finite size of the cloud, you have a quadrupole, and this is where the leading order corrections to the point-like structure of the cloud is. And this is basically the tidal force exerted by the companion on the cloud. Okay, let me explain what all these coordinates really are. So for small letters, I denote the coordinates of the cloud by small letters and the capital letters, the coordinates of the companion in this free-falling frame. Okay, and I also ignore high order multiple perturbations at leading order. Right, so because of the orbital motion of the binary, the coordinates of the companion are actually time dependent. So in particular, I have the time dependence in R. This basically characterizes the shrinking of the orbit due to gravitational wave emission in the binary. I have a time dependence in theta. So this is, if you have a precession of the orbit of the binary, you have a time dependent change in theta. And then this is a time dependence in phi, which characterizes the orbital motion, okay, of the binary. So it turns out that the most important time dependence in this perturbation is in phi, okay, for reasons I'll explain later. And since phi only appears in the spherical harmonics, it has this particular dependence, so e to the minus I m phi. Okay. And just to build on to this, so because this cloud is actually co-rotating in a particular direction, it rotates along the direction of the black hole. So there are two inequivalent classes of orbits characterized by the orientation of the orbit. So here, in one example, I have the cloud and this black hole rotating in the clockwise direction. Okay. So if the companion is orbiting along the same direction as the cloud, I call this class of orbits co-rotating orbits. And what this means in terms of phi is that it is given by positive, so plus, omega t, where omega is the orbital frequency of the binary and t is time. Okay? And on the other hand, if the companion is in spiraling in the opposite direction as the direction of spin of the black hole, this class of orbits are called counter-rotating. And what it means is that phi is given by minus of omega t. So if you substitute these expressions of phi into this expression here, you see that now you have e to the minus I m phi plus or minus omega t. And what this means is that the existence of an inspiraling companion sort of periodically drives the gravitational atom through an oscillating gravitational quadrupole. Okay. So just to have a sense of what kind of new dynamics I can have with this particular term, I think it's useful to take a step back and recall quantum our course in quantum mechanics, what happens in the case of the hydrogen atom. So in the case of a hydrogen atom, suppose you consider a two energy level state in the hydrogen atom, and you apply an external oscillating electric field on it. So these energy states have an energy gap of delta E, And the frequency of this external perturbation, I call it f. So in general, with an arbitrary frequency f, you can induce Rabi transitions between these two energy levels. However, when the frequency f matches with the energy difference between the two states, you can excite resonances between these two states. And what this means is that you can have an order one population between these two states. So drawing this analogy to the gravitational atom, the role of the external electric field is replaced by this in-spiraling motion, this gravitational perturbation that I just described earlier, where now the frequency is proportional to the orbital frequency of the binary. So in a similar fashion, for arbitrary frequencies of the orbit, you can still excite Rabi transitions between these two energy levels. However, when the orbital frequency matches with the energy difference between two energy levels, you can excite resonances between these two states. And that means, you can have an order one population of both of these states. However, again, unlike the hydrogen atom, in the case of a gravitational atom, I emphasize that these states are not all stationary. They are quasi-stationary. And what this means is that instead of oscillating to a stable mode, you can now oscillate and transition to a decaying mode. Okay, is this clear? Because I think this is perhaps the most important takeaway message I hope that I'll be able to impart in this talk. You know, the fact that now with the orbital motion of a binary, you excite new dynamics to the evolution of the cloud. Yeah, good. So it turns out, just like the hydrogen atom, not all level transitions are possible because these transitions are dictated by certain selection rules. So this is the mode that I have been emphasizing. The 2-1-1 mode is the dominant growing mode of the system. And this, along with the fact that now you're coupling it with a quadrupole perturbation, it turns out the selection rules dictate that you can transition downwards or upwards and not sideways into the L equals to 0 or the L equals to 2 mode, for example. So this transition here, so because the energy splitting, say, of order alpha 5, these are the hyperfine splittings, you transition within the same block, and you can also transition upwards where the energy difference is of order, the leading order Bohr-like energy levels, so alpha to the square along this direction. So this energy gap is much smaller compared to this upward transition here. And this, again, will play a very important role in the later part of my talk. Right.
Here we were assuming just the azimuthal.
Sorry?
Perturbation. So everything's coplanar.
Yeah, so here actually, I didn't quite mention. So here I'm assuming that the orbit is along the equator. Yeah. So in general, you can have precessions of the orbit as well. That's a good point. We suspect that with a different kind of inclination of orbits, you actually obtain different selection rules. That's a speculation and work in progress. So I mentioned just now that there are two classes of orbital orientations, and they actually play a very important part in my talk. So I remind you that there's a co-rotating orbit and counter-rotating orbit. So if you consider now the matrix element, where you consider the dominant growing mode 2-1-1 coupling towards a quadrupole and transitioning towards a decaying mode. So this term will be proportional to this oscillating term that I just described earlier, e to the I m phi omega t. So m star here will be fixed by the selection rules. And the sign ambiguity here basically is determined by what is the orientation of my orbit. So it turns out that if the orbit is co-rotating, then the type of resonances that you can excite are only those that transition downwards. And if the orbit is counter-rotating, the type of orbits that you can excite are those that only go upwards. And so because I mentioned that this, the energy difference between these two energy levels are of the order of hyperfine splitting, I call this type of resonances hyperfine resonances. And on the other hand, for this, the energy difference here are Bohr-like, so I call this type of resonances the Bohr resonance. Okay? And again, because the hyperfine energy difference is so small, if you recall that resonances are only excited when the orbital frequency matches with this energy difference, that means that hyperfine resonances happen when the binary is much further apart, where the orbital frequency is much smaller. Okay? And conversely, compare that to the counter-rotating orbit that excites Bohr resonances happen when the orbits are much closer to each other. So I've shown you this same figure just now, except that I've added two new scales here, where for Bohr resonances, I scale also like m over alpha square. Well, although it scales in the same way as the Bohr radius, it turns out that Bohr resonances always occur outside of the peak of this cloud. So that means that the multiple expansion that I'm performing is still valid. Okay? And then hyperfine resonances happen when the binary is much further apart, and it turns out it scales as alpha to the 4, inverse of alpha to the 4.
Good, just to make sure I'm following, the hyperfine happens when everything is in the same direction?
Co-rotating, that's right.
The
co-rotating one.
Direction as the angular momentum.
Right, so the direction of the orbit is, in the, is same, the same as the direction of the spin of the cloud. Okay, so the nice thing about this system, in my opinion, is that if you imagine having a binary that starts off far apart and gradually shrinks due to gravitational wave emission from the binary, it naturally scans through the resonances. Okay, depending on the orientation of the orbit. But the idea is that, so here I've shown you a figure where on the y-axis I have CD square, which is the occupation density of the decaying mode. On the x-axis, I have some dimensionless combination of the orbital frequency. So I start off, you know, at large distances where omega is small, then I gradually shrink due to the gravitational wave emission from the binary. For co-rotating orbits, where I have a red curve here, I excite resonances when you know, omega is relatively far apart compared to this. And I bring to your attention that this sharp increase in resonances, if you look at the y-axis, it really is a sudden spike from you know, 10 to the minus 8 to 1. So it really is you know, a really sharp transition. This is where the resonance effect comes in.
The width?
Sorry?
What's the width?
The width, I think it depends on how you define the width to begin with. So,
resonance, how big, how rapidly do you go through it?
That's right. So that is something that I'll discuss later on. Actually, so it turns out the effect of the depletion is characterized by the amount of time spent within this peak compared to the decay rate of the decaying mode. Yeah. That is actually the physical quantity. And so for counter-rotating orbits, for the blue curve, I excite Bohr resonances, which happen when omega is comparatively larger to the red curve. And so outside of resonances, once when I've detuned away from resonances, I mentioned earlier I can still have Rabi transitions between two energy levels. And that means that you know, out of resonances, these are small. I have still some occupation density to the decay mode, but they're non-vanishing. Okay, they're small, but they don't vanish. Again, actually, this dotted curve here, I've plotted here just to show that. So this dotted curve illustrates the characteristic Bohr radius of the cloud. I just want to illustrate that Bohr resonances happen outside of the cloud. Okay, so because of this new dynamical evolution of the cloud, and the fact that because of resonance, you can decay, the cloud can decay, the way that we quantify the amount of decay is given by an expression like this. So here, so let me explain what this is. So I have the ratio of the mass of the cloud at some particular time t over the mass of the cloud at some initial time where t is equal to zero. So this ratio would decay as would decay exponentially with a exponent of twice of a. So the factor of two here comes about because the mass of the cloud is quadratic in the field. And this a here, which I call the estimator, is something that Savas was pointing out just now. So let me explain what a is. So there are three components to this estimator. I have the decay rate of this decaying mode. I have an integral over time, which characterizes the amount of time that you actually spend shrinking a particular ring of orbit. And then I have CD squared, which is the occupation density of the cloud. So you should think of A as, so you have one combination here, this integral over time over the occupation density of the density mode as the amount of time spent by this cloud in the decaying mode. And this estimator A is the ratio of this amount of time spent in the decaying mode over the decay timescale of the cloud. So you can imagine having a scenario where even though the amount of time spent of this cloud in the decaying mode is long, but if the decay rate is very slow, the cloud essentially doesn't deplete at all. So really it is the ratio of these two timescales that quantify the amount of depletion of the cloud. Okay. So said differently, when A is really small, this ratio is roughly one, so you don't deplete. When A is of order one, you attenuate the cloud, but perhaps not completely deplete it. Whereas when A is much larger than one, you completely deplete the cloud. Okay. So it turns out the magnitude of A is quantified by two dimensionless parameters. First is quantified by this all-important parameter alpha. And on top of that is characterized by the mass ratio of the system. So Q is defined as the mass of the companion to the mass of the gravitational atom. So here I just want to sort of impress on you that depending on the combination of different values of alpha and Q, generically you can obtain three different types. So three different three qualitatively different types of evolution of the cloud. So on the y-axis, I have the ratio again, the ratio of the cloud at some orbital frequency over its initial orbital frequency. And on the x-axis, I have the orbital frequency rescaled such that resonances all coincide at a value of one here. And by the way, this graph is only valid for was not only valid, but here, for these particular lines, I've shown it for Bohr resonances without loss of generality. So the three qualitatively distinct cases are the following. So in the case of the light blue curve, I have the case where A, the contribution of A at resonances is really tiny, such that effectively the cloud just doesn't deplete and just survive through evolution. Survive through the Bohr resonances. In the case of the dark blue curve here, I have the case where the cloud receives an order one contribution. The estimator A receives an order one contribution near the resonances, but it doesn't completely deplete. And so there's still some fraction of mass of the cloud surviving the Bohr resonances. Then there's also another case. For this red curve, remember I mentioned that even though the frequency of the orbit is detuned away from the energy difference, you can still excite Rabi transitions between the two states. So you can still have excite decay of the cloud even before resonance happens. So this is illustrated by the red curve here, where I experience a significant amount of pre-resonance depletion due to these Rabi transitions. So all the way up here, and then I receive a sharper dip in A at resonance.
Why don't you have post-resonance depletion?
Sorry, come again?
So after the resonance, you're still in this regime where you're detuned, but on the other side of the resonance, right?
Sorry, I'm sure.
So as you go from left to right in the...
shrinking the orbit?
Shrink the orbit, so
yeah.
you're scanning your frequency through the resonance.
Yeah.
So before the resonance, there's a... So at the resonance, there's the biggest mixing effect.
Yeah.
There's mixing also before and after.
Right, that's right. So it turns out for this combination of parameters, these two cases, before the resonance, there's almost negligible amount of depletion, but for the red curve, there is a significant amount.
Right, but I'm asking about
after.
The dark blue curve, for example.
Yeah.
It looks like maybe it's just hard to see in the plot, but before the resonance, there's a little bit of depletion.
Yeah.
Is there also a little bit of depletion after the resonance?
Yeah, there is. Except that, so actually I didn't explain. These crosses are where my perturbation theory breaks down.
Yeah.
So I can't tell, you know what happens after this. Any questions? So actually, although I've only shown this particular graph for Bohr resonances, it turns out that you also have, you know, three qualitatively different cases for hyperfine resonances. Okay? But there's a crucial distinction between Bohr and hyperfine resonances, which is the fact that, again, because hyperfine resonances happen when the binary is much farther apart, so it spends a significantly longer amount of time inspiring in hyperfine resonances for the same combination of parameters alpha and q. Okay? So the real difference between Bohr and hyperfine resonances is this factor here of A, the amount of time spent in the resonance state. So for example, for counter-rotating orbits that I just showed you, that excite Bohr resonances, I experience, you know, some amount of dip. It doesn't completely deplete the cloud. For the same combination of parameters alpha and q, for co-rotating orbits, you actually experience, you know, a complete depletion of the cloud, just because you spend much longer decaying. Okay, does that make sense?
Is it really zero?
It's exponential. It's an exponential decay of the exponent is, you know, significantly larger than what's really zero. Here. Okay, so that's basically the end of part two of my talk. So moving on to part three, I'll try to briefly sketch.
What do you think happens when it's not coplanar? Let's say it's.
Yeah, you can actually. We think that you can actually excite different states. So. Yeah, so this is something that I didn't explain here. So it turns out that if you're coplanar, this mode can only decay to this m equals to minus one mode. And upwards, you can also only decay to the m equals to minus one mode. But actually, we have shown that this is work in progress, that if you have an inclined orbit, you can also excite these intermediate modes as well. So there are more modes they can decay to. Right, so moving on to part three, the last part of my talk, I'll try to briefly sketch some of the new phenomenologies associated to the resonance depletion of the cloud. But before I go into that, can I know how am I doing with time? So 5 minutes or?
10 minutes, you started a bit late.
10 minutes? Okay.
Don't worry about time.
Don't worry about time? Always worry about time. I wasn't planning to cover much in this section anyways, because I just want to illustrate what are the new observables associated to this system. And then I'll discuss how the new time dependence of the cloud because of this resonance effect gets imprinted on gravitational wave observables.
So coming back to this, so if it's not coplanar, you'll have more resonances. See.
And because the resonances will be very close to the peak. Yeah, there will be many of them. Actually, I also should mention, because we stick to coplanar situations, we can actually solve the system analytically, which is quite nice. But once you've tilted it, it turns out that it gets a little bit more complicated. Said differently, it is not just a 2x2 matrix element, but you have a larger matrix.
So did you take into account the time scale for annihilations with the natural?
I haven't mentioned that. You mean the annihilation? So the monochromatic gravity wave emission from the cloud? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that or...
Yeah, so that is much slower than the decay here because the decay here scales as alpha to the 9.
No, this is true.
Sorry.
But the time scale for the spirals to get to the point of resonance could be much longer. So here you're plotting the plots are a function of the period. They're not a function of time.
Through the resonance.
How long it takes to get to the resonance. So if you have a binary, it's that so far away, it would may take a couple of time to get to...
Right, sure.
So did you tell to see how close you have to start to the binary?
I'm not sure if you were here when I discussed... I'm not sure if you're here when I showed this particular plot.
I think is asking just, you know, when... there's the annihilation time scale, so you have some parameter that you fix when you show your plot. So if you take that alpha, you calculate how long it would have annihilated away, it might already be gone by the time you get
That would really depend on the initial condition of this cloud.
Exactly.
And so a lot of astrophysics that I've brushed away.
Some initial conditions are more crazy than others.
For example, there are two basic models of binary formation. One is that they start off at the time scale that it takes a billion years to merge, for LIGO, for example, and then they start off a few tens of millions of years, so at the distance. So the question is, if you take those priors into account, how instead of plotting there the frequency, the period of frequency, you should be plotting the time.
In physical time, right?
Yes.
This is just a general way of parameterizing the general feature of the shrinking.
But I'm telling you, for physical signatures, that's the relevant point.
Sure. I won't discuss in this talk about that. In this talk, we've briefly mentioned we've tried to address that consideration in our paper, but not discuss it because it gets a little bit messy when it comes to really talk about astrophysics. So again, as I advertised earlier, we can divide the discussion into signal from the cloud and signal from the binary. Okay, so the signal from the cloud, I remind you that if you have this cloud of boson condensate, this cloud actually sources monochromatic gravitational wave. So the hope would be that gravitational wave experiments such as LIGO or LISA would be able to not only observe this monochromatic gravitational wave, but also its resonant depletion, which is characterized by some particular time dependence. And I think if this is observed, it'd be really nice because not only will it be a strong hint that this signal really comes from a super radially generated cloud with an event horizon with a black hole in its center, at the same time it gives you, you know, independent probe of this alpha parameter I just described. Okay, so that's basically the signal from the cloud in a nutshell.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah, sure.
When you talk about, I don't remember the scale, there is a different mechanism for gravitational wave emission. One is transitions, and the other is annihilations.
Yeah, yes.
This formula refers to transitions.
Yeah, so this formula is actually for the annihilation.
For the annihilation.
So, I also didn't mention, so throughout my talk, I'm working the limit where this cloud is superradially generated. So really the only dominant, the only occupied mode is the 2-1-1 mode. So there's no transitions in that case, but only annihilations.
You can have transitions when it's superradiantly populated.
Sure, you can. But I did not consider
here. In your case, except when you're going through resonance, I mean, that effect that you have.
You mean when I excite the other decoupled? Yeah, that's possible.
But presuming that's slow, that's like short enough time that it's not very relevant.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Did you estimate that?
No, we did not.
Okay. What if you?
Yeah, because that's going to give you a different frequency of signals, so that would be interesting.
Yep. But when the 2-1-1 mode is occupied, the other modes are actually already decaying because the spin of the black hole is already small, right?
It doesn't matter. The gravitational wave emission with transitions is not something to do with the black hole in the middle. It's just the population of these two levels.
Right. But what I'm saying is that at superradiant saturation of the 2-1-1 mode, the other growing modes are already considered decaying modes. because the spin of the black hole is sufficiently small.
There are multiple time scales you need to take
into account. Right. Yeah. Okay. Is this, are you sure that time is okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
We have the room until Zurich.
I don't want to bother everyone's time. But,
okay, everyone's a free person.
Okay. So let me move on to the signal from the binary. So the way that the presence of the cloud leaves its imprint on the waveform of the signal coming from the binary are through finite size effects. So I explain what these finite size effects are, but the two that we'll be discussing are the spin-induced quadrupole that arises because of the spinning motion of the cloud, and the tidal deformity of the cloud. Basically, you can squish the cloud, essentially. So the main takeaway from this slide is that these finite size imprints affect the phase of the waveform. And phase is really the crucial, feature here because of match filtering. So match filtering works when you have a very strong phase agreement between your theoretical template of the binary with the signal. So if you imagine having an order one deviation of your waveform model and the signal, you could result in a misdetection. Okay. So it's tricky. I think it's also a very interesting challenge to construct highly accurate waveforms to capture all of these deviations from the background GR. Okay, so this program motivates for precision gravity and highly accurate waveforms. Just like the signal from the cloud, on top of these finite size effects, I think it'd be really cool and really nice if you can also measure and detect these resonant depletion of the cloud, because it will give us very strong evidence or suggest that these finite size imprints do come from super radially generated cloud with a black hole at the center. Okay, so in the rest of my talk, so I'll discuss the two finite size effects that I just described earlier. So for spin-induced quadrupole, the way this works is that because this cloud is co-rotating with the black hole, that co-rotation motion basically induces a quadrupole in the polar direction of the cloud. So in particular, if you look at this is my attempt to draw the configuration of the cloud view in this direction. If you plot the energy density of this cloud, it scales as sine square of theta. So said differently, if you project this configuration with Legendre polynomials of degree 2, which is a quadrupole, you actually get non-vanishing contributions. Okay. So the imprints of spin-induced quadrupole on the waveform appears at 2pn order. And if the spin of the black hole and the cloud is high, the phase shift induced would be larger. Okay. Now, on tidal deformability, because this cloud has finite spatial extent, the presence of a companion can exert tidal forces on this cloud, and that will basically induce a quadrupole on the cloud. So this is basically analogous to susceptibilities in electromagnetism. So in E&M, when you have, say, a material, and you apply an external electric or magnetic field on this material, the charges will redistribute themselves accordingly. And that redistribution is characterized by, so the response of that redistribution is characterized by the electric and magnetic susceptibilities. So in the case of gravity, the analogy is quantified in terms of something called the tidal Luff number. So its imprint on the phase of the waveform appears at 5pn order. So 5pn means that V to the 10. You might imagine that this is really, a really suppressed effect in general. But the nice thing is that Luff numbers intuitively scales as compactness of the object. For example, people have computed the tidal Luff number for a Schwarzschild black hole and find that it actually vanishes for a Schwarzschild black hole. For neutron star, by the way, Schwarzschild black holes meaning the most compact object that we know of in nature. For neutron star, which is probably the next most compact object that we know of in nature, has Luff numbers of the order of 1 to 10, depending on the equation of state of the neutron star. But for this cloud, if alpha is small, you can imagine that this cloud is really dispersed, it's kind of fluffy, And it, you know, it responds very dramatically towards some tidal forces exerted on it. So we expect the Luff number for this cloud to be very large. And that we hope that that large Luff number will be able to compensate for this small 5PN effect.
What does very large here mean?
So we've only done an order of magnitude estimate, but the order of 10 to the 5, again, depending on the value of alpha that we're considering.
And that takes into account the fact that there's a lot less mass in the cloud.
Yeah, yeah. So people have actually estimated the tidal Luff number for boson stars, and they found that the minimum value of tidal Luff numbers, well, depending on the potential that you consider, but is of the order of 100. Okay, so we expect that you can have much larger values of Luff numbers. But they're different things. Yeah, that's true. We can discuss about that. Yeah. Basically, you can take the free limit of the boson stars and restore this configuration. I'll explain. We can discuss about that later. So wrapping up part three of my talk, I just want to impress on you that in this figure, that resonance frequency can happen within the frequency bands of you know, LIGO or LISA. So here I've plotted a band of colors. So this band is the range of value of alpha. So on the upper end, I have 0.5, which I just described as the upper bound on the value of alpha. And the lower bound, I have about 10 to the minus 3. And so this lower bound is obtained because for smaller values of alpha, this cloud will not grow within the age of the universe. So we would not be considering that range of alpha. So I just want to impress on you that, you know, depending on the parameter alpha and the mass of this gravitational atom, different gravitational wave experiments, such as ground-based or LISA, will probe different ranges of parameter space. Yeah, so that's pretty much it, actually. So to summarize, I hope that I've convinced you that the presence of an orbiting companion introduces new dynamics to the problem, and in particular, these dynamics come in the form of resonant transitions of the cloud to a decaying mode. So we hope that these new phenomenologies provide an independent probe of the properties of the cloud, in particular this alpha parameter, and that may allow you to infer the mass of the scalar field. So I think now an open, an interesting question would be, you know, can we also probe other properties of the cloud? For example, can we tell apart whether this cloud consists of a scalar field or a Proker field, for example, through the orbital motion of the binary? Okay, so that's all. Thank you very much.
I guess a few quick questions. So I just want to organize the last part of the talk in my mind. So you have this effect that occurs when the binary partners are reasonably far apart, or farther apart than the Compton wavelength.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's this resonant excitation of the field living around the black hole. And then you discussed something else, which was basically the response of the cloud to a binary partner. And for that to be relevant, because it's higher PN, they need
right.
to be reasonably close together.
That's right.
So is there a tension there? I mean, do you decay away the cloud by the time you're close enough to see a signature of the gravitational waves? Or you're looking at the case where, anyway, is there any tension there? Maybe that's
I think an open question is still, we didn't really estimate what is the measurability of these effects. But intuitively, I would imagine that if you have large values of alpha, so meaning that the cloud is relatively compact, and so resonances will excite when the orbits are much closer to each other, so that might be the regime where these finite size effects can appear more prominently in the interspiral stage of the waveform.
But for larger values of alpha, the Luff number and stuff is also smaller. So.
Yeah, so there's actually a competition of the effect. That's right. Yeah.
I think it'll be very interesting to actually estimate what
right.
the observables are.
I agree. Yes.
Sorry.
And so just related to that, can you just tell us, like, for example, what would be like a favorable, like, or sort of most favorable scenario, what mass ratios you're imagining are supermassive versus stellar mass, or what values of alpha if you just had to depict some reasonable ones that would be most ideal for this type of signal?
That's a good question that I keep asking myself, actually. I think having emeries, so meaning extreme mass ratio in spirals, where you have a large black hole at the center with a large cloud around it, and having a small, say a star or a smaller black hole in spiraling on it.
A million to one mass ratio?
Sorry?
Like a million to one mass ratio?
Yeah, roughly, yeah. So in that case, you actually, so that would be the type of sources that's being probed by LISA. And the nice thing about LISA is that you can actually observe many cycles. And with that large number of cycles, you might be much more sensitive to phase deviations from just a background GR waveform. Yeah, I would say MREs actually. And perhaps for Bohr resonances. Because for Bohr resonances, they happen much closer. So Bohr resonances happen when the binary is much closer. So the V, so the PN effects become more prominent when they're much closer, right? So that I think that would be also an interesting regime, where finite size effects do imprint on the waveform. Any other questions?
Maybe this is for further discussion, but so you had this very nice picture. You have the field sourced by the companion black hole and how that drives the transitions.
Yeah.
But as far as I understood, you were looking at a static potential, so which would be the analog of, say, the electric quadrupole transition in a hydrogen atom. So did you think about basically gravito-magnetic effects where you have the spin orbit coupling of the other black holes?
So gravito-magnetic effects, they are post-Newtonian effects in the sense that so here I've only considered Newtonian potentials.
Right.
And gravito-magnetic effects come as relativistic corrections in the potential, in the perturbation. So we have not considered that.
So
in this work.
For example, for the Bohr orbit, you might expect that those are not so far off and they will mix different levels.
They might,
so that
might be important. That's right.
I guess that's the speaker again.